This is Gordon Bowrer, interviewed at his home at Upton-by-Chester in Cheshire by Chris Alden Lee on the 21st of September 2010. Gordon Bowrer, Part 2.
Let's look at the first year, then, 1963. And I've got in front of me, Gordon, the base reports for the station on those 2 years that you were there. And part of what they were trying to do was to do with the ionospherics.
Yes.
And this may not be your territory, but I gather there was quite a few problems with the ionospheric research. Were you aware of that?
Only sort of by the way.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I didn't know why, or how they were trying to solve it. But I know there were problems with most things, really.
Well, one of the points that I was going to ask you about was the quality of equipment issued to Halley, which seems to have been perhaps a bit substandard compared to that which being issued to the West Coast bases. Was that something you recall?
I can't answer that because I have no idea. I would have thought it was the same, but I would have no... haven't got a clue. That certainly never came up as far as we were concerned.
But the conditions you were in were somewhat harsher than the West Coast.
Oh, absolutely. The banana belts of high temperatures and going positive.
So shouldn't you have...
we didn't have that.
Shouldn't you have had better equipment?
Oh, are you talking of clothing?
Everything, yeah.
I can't answer that. We were in a period, as I say, it was still post-war. It was still make do and mend. It was still... I mean, I think the radios we had, I think, were Army 68 sets or something like that, which were, we were trying to use them over 300 miles, but they were normally used for talking over 6 or 7 miles, you know. We tried to make things work, and that included everything. We really were using things outside their normal... their normal thoughts of what they would do.
And did this apply?
And that included some of the things that went down. I mean, we had some motor toboggans came down called Eliassons. Because of the frequency of their breakdown, they became known as Elsans. And they were never really... while they might have forecast the future... And being mechanical dogs, they were not it. There was no way they were going to take over from the dogs. But the eventual skidoos was a different kettle of fish, I think. But we didn't have any.
So you had to go through the pain of the Eliasson in order to reach the success of the skidoo.
And I think we also had I've forgotten what it was called, basically a Gypsy Moth Major engine on skis, which would do 100 miles an hour over Canadian lakes, and said to have a payload of 2,000 pounds. But we never managed, it could not take the conditions of the air, and very rapidly became base leader's transport, I think.
You didn't go anywhere?
No, never went anywhere.
And that was because of major design faults, or just being used the wrong
way? Not as... again, it was, I think, more experimental.
Yeah.
But I think there were two. I think there was one on the peninsula, and I don't know what happened to that. We don't know what really happened, but it wasn't useful as far as travelling. The one things that were good travellers were the muskegs, and they were extremely good, apart from in deep soft snow, but they were extremely good.
They were modified quite a bit, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you tell me about that? What do you recall of that?
I can't remember too much of the modifications. They became motor caravans, if you like. So there were sleeping berths put in the two newer ones where we went down. We had four motor caravans. We had four musk eggs. The ones used for the expedition were the ones with the bigger cabs. There were all sorts of things about the heating system, of which I can't remember now, but I realise there were problems with
this. Is preheating the engine?
Yes, yeah. And quite interesting to see one being started with a blow lamp on the carburetor manifold. Yes.
Well, there's a problem with spare parts, I believe.
I wouldn't know.
No.
But I do know that that Barry Cranbull rebored an engine. Took him about a week for each cylinder, fitted with oversized rings. I do remember that, which was, I think was a very major piece of fettling. But Barry was very good at fettling, and so were Dudley Gin. Dudley was base leader in the second year, but the first year he was just a... he was a tractor mechanic.
Well, he, in his section in the base report for 63, he goes on to say that the modified musk eggs have now paid dividends, but the trick is to make sure there's lots and lots and lots of spare parts.
Absolutely.
For every eventuality.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you become the victims of a false economy.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, it's like everything. You never know what's going to go wrong.
So do they become reliable, useful tools in your time?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, the musk eggs were, yeah.
And could you see them even then becoming the dominant motive transport for the Antarctic over dogs?
Oh, yes, if you didn't have other vehicles.
Right.
But I mean, the musk eggs were Canadian tractors, basically. They were just over-snow tractors. And if you turned them into a motor caravan, so to speak, that was an expedition vehicle. So you could actually sleep in the cabs.
Mm-hmm.
And you could that you could travel 24 hours a day, as we did on the way back from laying the... ionospheric station, which we put 200 miles south of Bob Pye. We travelled 24 hours and got back really virtually to the crossing in that 24 hours.
They later, of course, proved to be fatal in one or two instances. There were some fatalities later on. In the Halley Bay area, was there any sense that they had this downside to them when you were there?
There was no downside to the tractors. It's a question of what you did with the tractors and how you used them. We did lose somebody on the ice, but that was dogs. He was out with training a dog team.
This is Neville Mann.
That's Neville Mann. Neville Mann. But the year after, they lost three people in a musk egg going down a crevasse. Although they were being used differently then to the way we used them, because I believe that they were towing the dogs. Or towing the dogs on sledges. Now, we never did that. That would mean that you could get out to the mountains earlier. But as far as we're concerned, we went out virtually when it was light and came back when it was dark. But both the travel there and the travel back... or you were travelling at the extremes of temperature, not as comfortable as summer. And I think it was when the tractors went out the first time, I think it was minus 45.
So because they were stretching the season, shall we say,
yes,
men were in the muskegs rather than following them.
Yes.
Or the muskegs were leaving rather than following dogs.
Yes. Now, we might think about dogs going first over, because... but I don't know anything about that, because I don't know the area concerned. But I suspect it was unknown. I suspect that they were probably travelling in when there was low drift and maybe not seizings.
I think they were off course. That was a problem. Well, when you heard about that the year after you'd been there yourself, do you remember how you felt about it? Were you surprised or frustrated that this should happen?
No, I mean, I was working as a casualty surgeon at that time and got hounded by the journalists, trying to do my job at that time. So I didn't know anything about it. I was just... People were coming into the casualty and saying, oh, what do you know about... You know, have you got any pictures of dogs and sledges and things like that? And I... had a few, and they were shown, I think, on television, of the vehicles that were taken.
So that incident became national news then?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And you were bothered by journalists for your opinion?
Yes, when I was, as I say, I was in London, talking about Hyde Park Corner, you know, that's easy journalist. You reach there from Fleet Street, can't you?
So was your response no comment?
They wanted some pictures.
Right.
And I think I probably had four or five black and white pictures.
So whilst the journalists were after the story, what was your internal feeling? Were you... I know one or two fits were quite angry at how sort of that could have happened.
No, I mean, things happen. The reasons behind them, I didn't know enough to... Mm. You can never tell what had actually happened. You knew what I knew what crevasses were, and I knew how easy it was to get them to get something down a crevasse. And I also knew that even if you knew they were there, as happened with our accidents, it was other things that took over. For instance, the bridges may be very thick, as it was when we went down with the dogs. It was a very thick bridge. There's no way that could carry anything, except it collapsed at the same time we were on it. It was nothing to do with the thickness of the bridge. It was that the actual crevasse was opening up, I guess, and just happened... I mean, that place where when Gordon Mallinson and I went down a crevasse, the next 6 months later, it was an ice fall, not a crevasse.
So I'll come to that in just a moment. But just going back to when you heard about the accident with a muskeg, so are you saying you weren't that surprised to hear that?
No, not that surprised.
Fatalities, yeah. It was... The risk you took?
Well, yeah. We'd had a death when we were there. There were previous accidents. They're all accidents, but why they occurred...
Hmm.
And you're a long way from base there. My thoughts were for the fella left on the top. I don't see how he could cope easily. Certainly... by himself, and I knew what the communications were likely to be if they were using the same stuff that we were using.
Which they were.
Which, I mean, basically we were out of contact for 3 months at the time when we were out there. So I knew that there would be very great difficulties.
And the Neville Mann incident, that was whilst you were there.
Yes.
What do you remember of that?
My recollections are there are two bays where Halley Bay is. Halley Bay and Emperor Bay. Emperor Bay, well known because there was a huge amount of emperor penguins. It was a huge rookery.
Yeah.
And the two that we were going, we were training dogs, and Sam and myself were with a full team on Emperor Bay, and Nev Mann and Gordon Mallinson had half teams each. They had four dogs each, I think, and they were training on Halley Bay. I can't remember exactly when it was during the year, but...
we know that already, don't worry about that.
We do remember, Sam and I saw snow coming off the high cliffs. Once you see blowing snow, you know it's blowing. So we were getting off the ice. We got off the ice. Sam and I got off the ice in the big team. And by the time we got back to base, the two of us, it was doing 60 knots. So it really was blowing a howling gale. And not long after we got back, Gordon Mallinson came back, but there was no sign, and he hadn't seen Nev. And I remember we got a muskeg out, and we tried to go down to Halley Bay then. And at that time, as I say, the visibility was appalling. And I can remember being roped to the front of the muskeg so that we would not go over the cliffs. Well, we got in the wrong position and could feel that there's something wrong, but not see. By the time we got down there, of course, it was dark, and we had to retreat out of it. And I think two of us went out onto the ice. It was Dudley and myself. Barry Cranbull was driving the tractor. Can't remember who else was with us. I think there were six of us, but I can't remember that exactly. But I do know that Dudley and myself went out onto the ice, which happened to be moving, shining lights onto the ice front to see if we could see anything at all. But it very clearly became clear that there was nothing one could do on the ice at all. And we retreated from that. And that's what I remember about that. There was absolutely nothing you could do at that particular time on that day. And we knew the ice was moving.
Moving out or moving
up? Oh, up and down, up and down.
We breaking knew it up?
Was, well, we don't know it was breaking up because, I mean, it was as far as the horizon the ice was, so we didn't know that it was breaking up. We couldn't go to where the sea started, not that day, because it was sea ice, but... this was during the spring. And sure enough, it did break up. Everything broke up. And in fact, that Emperor Penguin rookery just disappeared. So something that was 60,000 odd birds there just disappeared.
Perished?
We don't know. Went out to sea. The birds wouldn't perish, but the young birds would. Anything that was... Any youngsters that were there would perish, yes, I think. We don't know.
Was this an exceptional wind or something?
Yes.
Beyond your normal experience?
Yes. Yes, sea ice had never been out, to our knowledge, before.
What
that time of year. Normally, sea ice breaks back right in the spring. And that would be, what, February-ish? But this was September odd, I think. I can't remember.
That doesn't matter. We've got a notice of that. You must have discussed what might have happened to Neville. Did you come to any guesstimate about
that? I don't think we could make any. We know that there were four. He had four dogs. We didn't know where he was. There was no. We didn't know what had happened. We don't know whether he went into the water. We don't know whether he was on an ice floe. We just don't. We couldn't speculate. He didn't have a tent, I don't think. I don't know. Maybe he did. They probably. We always, when we went out, we always had tent, and if we were going on the ice, just in case. So shelter. We don't know what. I can't remember what was on the small sledges. Mm. I really can't remember.
But you presume that he would have perished.
Yes. Pretty, yes. Yeah. But why? We don't know.
On how?
Or how? No, we've got no idea.
So he was doing nothing wrong. It was just
absolutely not. I wouldn't have thought. I mean, I just don't know where he was.
Mm.
And while there were two of them on the ice together, I don't know how individualistic. They were both individualists. So I just don't know how close they were to each other. But clearly Gordon didn't know where he was.
What was the... how did that change the dynamics of the base, either permanently or temporarily, the loss of a man?
I think I find that difficult to answer, really. It was really a dreadful thing that somebody had perished alone. I think it was the loneliness of that that. Yeah.
Did it change the way the base operated? Were there new rules or regulations brought in to avoid it from happening again, or was that not feasible?
To be honest, I can't remember that. I doubt that we... I mean, we were still going to do our big journeys, and it's the big journeys where life is very much more on an edge than around the base.
Mm.
But I suppose there are more people around the base at a particular time, and therefore things are more likely that something will happen around a base as opposed to... at a distance. But that was something we really thought. That was the reason that I went out as a doctor went out. We really thought that most of our problems would be over the crevassed area, and that was where things were likely to happen.
Okay. You touched briefly on your own crevasse experiences with Gordon Mallinson, is that correct?
Yes.
And in fact, there were two sets of experiences, one where the dogs went down and one where you went down yourself.
Yes, that's right.
Can you tell me a bit more about those?
Well, the one where both these crevasses were, or they were, we had some knowledge there were holes there. The top one, we came down on a lovely day, and it was one dog running wide that pulled the whole team down. And we were just entering the crevassed area at that time. There was a flag, so the flag marked where we thought was the start of the crossing problems. But there was no individual in front of the dogs. The dogs were running. We were driving the dogs at that time, left and right, but one dog ran very wide and fell down the hole and pulled the rest of the team after him. Didn't pull the sledge in, but it was a narrow thing. And the dogs went down about 90 feet, and they were all on a ledge. None of them injured themselves, and Gordon Mallinson abseiled down, and we pulled them all out. because there were three of us on top at that time. There were four of us, two sledges travelling together. And pulled them all out with no casualties amongst the dogs.
Were they still on their leads, on their spans? Or that's not the correct phrase. Were they still on the in their harnesses?
Well, we pulled them up in their harnesses. We did pull them up in their harnesses. So the harnesses must have held at that time. So we pulled, I think all but one fell down. I think we had one dog. But we gradually pulled them up and none of the dogs were injured. It's amazing.
The decision to go after them, was that an easy decision to make?
Well, yes. Dogs down there, we want to get home, get the dogs up.
Well, the alternative not manhauling.
Not a problem. Don't fancy manhauling. And anyway, we didn't. The sledges weren't in good condition at that time. Mm. They were suffering from overuse. They'd been out 6 months, and we that was a lot. We were returning at the end of 6 months in the field.
And when you yourself went down, what do you remember of that particular incident? I guess this is fairly burnt into your memory, I think.
Well, that was one where the dogs were over the crevasse.
They'd gone through it, gone past it.
They'd gone over it. Mm. We knew the crevasse was there. It was a very big crevasse. And it was a very thick bridge. There wasn't a problem about the bridge giving way. It didn't give way as such. It just dropped. What we remember is just falling. And the trace of the dogs was in the lip of the crevasse and held the sledge up, if you like. But all you could see was the trace, and the dogs had just scattered, so they'd got themselves out of their harnesses just like that. We didn't see that because Gordon and I were down the crevasse. I was travelling with Gordon Mallinson at that time. And the other two, Sam and and Dick, suddenly just saw spare dogs knocking around. And so obviously they were somewhat taken aback.
Do you remember what was going through your mind when you came to down the crevasse? How deep were you and what were your feelings about it?
Well, we can't have been that. We must have been about, I don't know, 20 to 30 feet down.
That's a long way.
We were the length of the trace, and it was being held by the harnesses, not the harnesses of the dogs. There was no dog on the end of the harness at that time. The dogs had scattered like that, but the harnesses were holding up the sledge.
Which was down the crevasse with you?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you think your time was...
like that.
Yeah, there's a photograph here that Gordon is showing me. Was your number up? Did you think your number was up at that
no,
point?
No, we never thought that.
But we
wanted to get out. Quite simple. Throw us a rope. Let's get out of here.
So again, you were not injured.
No, we weren't injured. Well, I mean, we were just... we didn't. I don't think we did anything. I think we lost a ski. I think that's about...
You did indeed, yes.
Well, I can't remember anything else now.
So was it a fairly quick rescue then?
No, it took us some time. Unload a sledge, pull it up. Quite heavy and difficult.
So, take me through the process. And you unloaded the sledge to get that out first?
Yes, right? Yeah.
So you stayed down there?
Yes.
To do this?
Yes.
And presumably they hauled the sledge up, then they hauled all the...
Yeah, that's right.
All the gear up.
Yeah.
And then finally
I think we left this. I think I really can't remember, but probably the sledge was the last thing. We probably came up and I mean, all this is manual, you understand, mm-hmm. And therefore heavy.
Okay.
And it took us some time.
But you were, afterwards, you were unaffected by the experience?
No, I don't think we were affected, but, well, I mean, you know, we were a bit... can't remember talking to Gordon about that much. Both of us had been clearly involved with, all of us. Sam, Dick wasn't involved. But we'd been involved with Nev's demise. Just life, that was part of things as they were. The Dawson Lambton Glacier was not a happy place to cross. Mm-hmm. And Dick and I, when I think I was with Dick when we went out, you could feel it moving down. You could feel the slabs moving as you were on them. You could feel them moving as you were... as you were going up the slope.
So would you regard that as a lucky escape in retrospect?
Oh, I suppose so, yes. It must be. Got to be, hasn't it? Got to be lucky.
Let's talk about less dramatic times.
Yeah.
I mean, you went on two big journeys. The first one in March 63, the Autumn Dog Journey, when you went up to the Totten Mountains. Totten Mountains, I beg your pardon. And this was in Martin Winterton, is that correct?
Oh, that was the first one, yes. That was That was in the autumn. And that's when we had muskegs, dogs and Eliassons. I think we had the lot then, as far as I remember. And we were at different places at different times. And we didn't have very good weather. We had very bad weather then, I remember.
Do you remember losing the dogs?
Yes.
You were out for 26 days and 14 of them were spent in lie-up, so...
Yeah, so it's a poor... I think it usually worked out at about half the time would be spent in lie-up, yeah. Something like that.
170 miles.
Yeah, is that what we did? Mm. Did we really...
When was so there's a story about losing the dogs one day.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
This is on the 19th of March.
Is it?
Tell me the story.
I think we'd just stopped. I can't even remember what time of day, how soon it was into our journey.
It was lunchtime.
Oh, was it? Right, Martin and I were... there was nobody else around. There were no muskegs or... We were alone, as far as we were concerned. I don't think there were... No, there wasn't any muskegs around. And normally you tether the sledge. I think we were putting our skis on or off or something. We just stopped. And the dogs took off and... Both of us missed hanging on to the sledge. It took off by itself. Oh, God. That was not a happy time.
So what did you do about it?
Well, we followed them quickly as we could. And eventually, I mean, you could tell the tracks of the dogs. And eventually they had a fight or something like that and we came upon on the sledge. I can't remember how many miles later it was, but it was a long way.
Eight miles.
8 miles, was it? Mm-hmm. I didn't write that up. Presumably Martin did he?
This is a base report.
Yes. Yeah.
That's not a base report. It's a...
Sledge report.
Sledge report, and I don't know who wrote it, sadly. But
well, it will be Martin Winterton.
Yeah.
Because he was a dog man. And I was travelling with Martin.
He's referring himself... At the same time, the dog decided to move off with Martin hanging onto the sledge. So whether he wrote about himself in his own name, I don't know. Do you know why the dogs went?
No, dogs can be very... they can be very skitterish. And when they've been out a long time, they can be reluctant to go, if you see what I mean. No, I can't remember why they went. I really can't.
It took you 3 hours to get to them.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the dogs had tied the trace in knots.
Yes.
And one of the pups had it wrapped around his leg. He was in great pain, but nothing was broken. Wilfred was covered in blood and had a bad fight wound on his right cheek.
Did he? Wow, wow, wow.
And both of us were exhausted and were forced to camp straight away.
Well, we would.
Yeah. And again, when you saw them disappear into the distance, did you imagine you would always catch them again, or was there a question of doubt?
Doubt.
Really?
Oh, yes.
And if you hadn't caught up with them?
Well, we would have perished. It's as simple as that.
Because everything you had was on the sledge.
Oh, yes. Yes. But interesting to... you have to talk to Martin about that, what he thought about it. Very interesting. Is Martin part of your...
Not yet, but you never know.
Interesting. Yeah.
He goes on to say, we've been very lucky. Now, that's your third lucky escape in the last 2 hours, Gordon.
yeah, but the other two came later.
Yes. What I'm saying is you had...
The other three came later, if you like, because of the one when Nev went out on the mound, and in fact the keg nearly went over the top of the ice cliff.
Were you having a charmed life, or did you think there was more to it than that?
No, it's just part of normal life, living at that time. I mean, we were young. You're invulnerable at that time, aren't you? When you were young, you would do all sorts of things, wouldn't you? And at that time, you know, we were doing things that we wanted to do.
Did your own mortality ever cross your mind?
Not at that time, but I mean, you must realise that actually the first 6 inches of going through the top of snow is exactly the same as going down 30 feet. You relive it all the time. Even, you're aware that things can happen, but you prefer not to talk about them, think about them, I think.
This is the Battle of Britain pilot fighter mentality.
Some
FIDs who did have a number of lucky escapes came to the conclusion they were being looked after by a greater being. Did that ever cross your mind?
Not my mind, no.
No, okay. So you didn't turn to religion at all?
No.
No, okay.
No, not at all.
Something else from 63 of MA. In an effort to stop parts of the base going nocturnal, 9 a.m. was the latest anyone could lie in bed. Except on Sundays. And the base leader goes on to recommend this for future years to make an effort to combat nocturnalism.
Yes. You became wrapped up in what you were doing during the evening and would go later and later, I guess. I don't think it was anything to... When it's dark, you actually had to have some... You couldn't tell... really what time of day it was. So therefore, the clock was... it was very easy, if you were working on something, to work later and later. And that did occur to one person in particular, yeah.
Did you have any input into this decision as a doctor? That it was bad for people to... for their body clocks to become so...
It is bad. Yeah, it is bad. But I wasn't aware of having an input. I might well have had, but I can't remember.
Okay.
I might well have had.
But you remember the decision being taken to be more...
Oh, regular. Yes, I can remember. Well, I can't actually. But it doesn't seem unreasonable to me.
Okay.
It's important not to get... I mean, first of all, you... you know, your meal times have got to be, you've got to occur. Otherwise, it's not fair on the cooks if everybody's in bed. I don't think that could happen. It never really. I can't remember that.
So breakfast in bed was not an option?
No, absolutely not. Okay.
There was some concern because you were underground and there were coal fires in these underground huts. There was concern about carbon monoxide.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell me about that, please.
Well, at certain stages, we did have carbon monoxide detectors. There were glass tubes. And sometimes they were very high. And if I show... I'm not sure I've got a black and white photograph, but to look at the chimneys going, the chimneys did not go straight up. But even if they didn't go straight up, the cold air could fall down the chimney when it was very cold, and you couldn't get the gases away. So the bottom hut in particular was subject to... in order to have the heat in there, you had to have we were talking about coal fires, and therefore there was a risk of carbon monoxide poisoning. And as far as I remember, we had to, during the second year, we had to have people sleeping down there because there wasn't room in the other hut. And I think I was one of those. I think there were five of us. I can't really remember, but I think there were five people slept in the lower hut. Really, because of the lack of space, we had 30 people in the second year.
So, were precautions taken of any kind?
Well, there was always a night met. There was always somebody up in the buildings, and to make sure that things were all right as far as the fires were concerned. But yes, there is a great risk of fire underground, obviously people not escaping. There have been deaths because of fire, and those were in huts that were above ground. We were underground. I can't begin to tell you how bad it would be if there was a fire.
The carbon monoxide detector has been very useful and very accurate.
Mm.
It tells you just how strong your headache should be.
Yes. Well, used to get headaches.
From carbon monoxide?
Yeah.
And that was another detector, was it, the headache?
I suppose you could put it that way. You can't.
So one lived with this problem rather than...
Oh, I think you lived with all the problems. They were their problems you had to live with. I mean, you could alter them as much as you could. But, you know, life was, as I say, it was not as it is today. So
if in the IGY hut, for example, the deeper hut, the fire had become a problem, would there be an escape route or would that be curtains?
Well, there were two escape routes. There was the shaft and there was the steps down. But again, you know, carbon monoxide is heavier, isn't it? Heavier than air. So it would be at the bottom. So you'd have to get your nose above it.
It was a bad year for weather, wasn't it? The emperor penguins suffered only 10% chicks.
It just disappeared. The whole emperor colony disappeared. It came back to some extent in the Chippentod Creeks. I think there was a few there. But the main emperor penguin colony just disappeared. It just went out to sea and never came back to Emperor Bay, as far as I'm aware.
And you were very short of seals, and the ship had to bring extra seals for you. Only 45 seals caught that year.
Right. First of all, we brought down another dog team. So there would be more dogs. And in fact, the second year, they brought two more dog teams. Now, I remember we took 10 elephant seals from South Georgia down on... which was the coldest I've ever been in the Antarctic. We happened to be in South Georgia when we were sealing for these elephant seals. Now, they're about 2 tons each, so there's a lot of seal meat with those. I don't think we ever ran out of seal meat while I was there. I can't remember.
And one final note about Neville Mann. A cairn of Totten Rock with plaques and crosses erected on First Chippentod Headland. In future years, please see the wood is oiled regularly.
Well, the wood was from the case of an X-ray machine which came down is that right? I can't remember when it came down, but anyway, the wood was from that. The bricks were from magnetic bricks, as far as I'm concerned. I can't remember much about it. Was beautifully carved by, I can't remember who did the carving, probably Dudley, I suppose.
Dudley Jehan.
Jehan, yeah.
And there was a ceremony of sorts?
Oh, yes. But I can't remember. I think eventually it went on a sledge so that it could be moved around. But I've got pictures of it. I've got pictures of that.
Let's move forward then to the second season, if we may, Gordon, which is 1964, and the Halley Bay report from that year. And this one talks about your frustrations with the hand skin temperature experiments, due mainly to instrument shortcomings.
I couldn't get it to work,
your frustration, yes. It also talks about using more bitches in the sledging season. That's just proving very successful. Sledging was mainly male dog dominated.
You would always have to have a bitch or a couple of bitches. I think we had a couple of bitches in each. We actually lost one bitch in the mountains. Pam.
Yeah.
I think we lost that dog.
Do you remember how?
No, I can't. Got free, ran off, and didn't return. And I don't know why. I can't remember why. I might have had it in my... Well, the sledge report of that trip would be done by me. So it should be possibly in there somewhere.
It is. I've already found it, but I can't find it.
Right. Well, I can.
You're quite right. She did vanish,
We did expect her back because I can't really think.
Did you hang around for her?
Yes, as far as I remember. But I can't remember where we were actually, but in the mountains somewhere.
Okay.
Beautiful mountains.
That was the year of your big trip, on which Pam was one of the dogs taking.
Yeah.
Part in the mobsters team, and this was a 6-month trip.
Yes.
To the Totten Fela. Starting in July. October 63 through to April 64. Mm. What are your abiding memories of that particular expedition?
Well, the beauty of the mountains, to be honest. The beauty of the. This huge range of mountains, all of which was unclimbed peaks.
Did you conquer any of them?
Oh, yeah, all of them. All bar one, actually. Yeah, we didn't go up one.
You hinted earlier about the feelings you had when you broke through virgin territory, so to speak. Can you elaborate on that a bit, when you conquered mountains that hadn't been trodden?
Well, I don't think they were conquered. You went up the easy way.
Well, you were the first man up there, I think.
Well...
You were the
between the four of us, yes.
A Neil Armstrong moment, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it was when, I can remember one of them just having been to the top of one bit of rock. And that was when Kennedy was assassinated. That was the first time we'd heard any radio at all. And we heard, this was the South African radio program, And we couldn't believe it, really. We'd just come back and think, oh, Kennedy was so... You always knew where you were when Kennedy was assassinated. We also heard the Beatles for the first time as well.
Picking them up from South African radio.
Yeah, South African radio. Yeah. Yes, we'd been out of touch of radio for a long time at that time. But we could actually... Yes, we can actually pick up the South African station.
The object of this trip was to do a topographical, geological and biological survey
yes.
of the area, as well as carry out physiological work on husky bitches. This is the thermometer job, is it, or something else?
Well, no, this was... we did try to stop the bitches from coming on season during trips by giving them, I think it was called megestrol acetate, as far as I remember.
A contraceptive.
And that worked during the period we were out, because we were out for a long time. A bitch on heat is a real problem with two dog teams. would be a real problem, I suspect.
How do you administer this?
By mouth.
Right. Disguised as food, or...?
No, just pop it down their throat.
Was it a tablet, was it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Not a problem.
Do you know where this originated from, this idea?
Yes, well I mean, we started from one of the vets. Can't remember.
Bellas?
Was it Andrew? Might well have started from Andrew.
I'm guessing.
I just can't remember, actually. It's probably down in the papers somewhere, but I've forgotten.
So you put the dogs on the pill?
Yes.
For the duration of their
yes
field trip?
Well, their field trip, yeah.
And they stop them from coming into heat?
Yeah.
Innovative idea, isn't it?
Seemed a good idea at the time, like lots of things.
So your job
sometimes they're good ideas, sometimes they're not, but it seemed one.
So one of your duties was to monitor the effectiveness of this?
Yes, well,
yeah.
They quite enjoyed it sometimes. We have some pictures of various of the bitches being fed. Oh dear.
What else do you remember from this particular trip, Gordon?
I think the sense of achievement at the end of it when we got back to base. But it had been a long trip, and all the equipment that we had, and by that I mean the sledges and things like that, we did not have we had one intact bridge between two sledges. They were repaired with rope and things like that. Things were wearing out. The Lampwick harnesses of the dogs. You know, basically, everything was worn out. Really. No, the one abiding memories of, I suppose, of unknown territory. And the beauty of it, and the fact we were, I suppose, lucky to be back at base, or, you know, having fallen down a couple of holes. But that wasn't the only things. We had incidents when we were in the mountains.
How do you mean?
Well, we had a very big blow. One place we tried to get to, lovely, wonderful campsite with a tremendous view over everything, but it started to blow, and that went on for about 6 days, and we ran out of food, the two of us. I had to move in the end. There were obviously crevassed regions that we didn't... Well, I mean, we don't... You know, when you're dealing with unknown territory, you can very rapidly get yourselves into problems and find actually climbing some of the bits of rock, you can find that the only way up is over through a we try to stick to the rock rather than the snow around it, but sometimes it isn't possible to do, and you're either going to get up there or you're not. So I think we had some interesting moments in climbing.
I mean, you're a doctor, not an explorer.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
This was increasingly alien territory for you, wasn't it, really?
Oh, it's lovely. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I had been, as a doctor, one is... let's say you become... you follow the normal doctor's thought that life is all medicine. There is no life outside medicine. And suddenly I was finding there was a life outside. There were things outside medicine. And we'd been brainwashed into total immersion into medicine. And suddenly there's a life outside.
Liberation.
Very interesting.
Liberating?
Liberating in some ways, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
When you are away from base for 6 months, living hand-to-mouth in a raggedy old tent, does it change... How does it change you? How does it change your thinking at that time?
I have no idea. You have to retain a sense of humour, and in fact, a sense of humour is the most important thing about having a good year. I think, a sense of the ridiculous. People get themselves into ridiculous situations. Quite a few ridiculous situations, and you have to have a sense of humour about it. And if you don't, I would imagine it would be very difficult. I was very lucky. It was a wonderful time of my life. It really was. I can't imagine without it. And the fact we still see people around, not necessarily so many from my year, but we see all sorts of people that have been in other situations, in reunions. Once you retired, you tend to go to we have tended to go to reunions. And that's because we like the company. And different people of all walks and professions. Some of them are in professions, but some are not. Some just without so-called qualifications. So everybody has a job, but actually the general assistant is the most qualified person that's ever been down there.
Jack of all trades.
Jack of all trades, yes. Yeah, so very difficult to get good general assistants. Yeah, Martin was a general assistant.
And were you as well, in a way?
Well, yeah, in a way, I suppose.
Apart from the reunions, on a broader scale, how do you feel, looking back now, your Antarctic experience has shaped... or moulded you for the rest of your life?
Totally.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I mean, I think it has, totally. I think the jobs that you've taken would also be to do with occupation. In my case, of occupation rather than pure medicine. Or surgery. Some people have gone up the pure medicine and surgery. Some people have gone into general practice. People like Neil Orr is a surgeon. Other people are general practitioners. But there are more people, I think, that have followed into occupational medicine, having been down south. Maybe I'm wrong. So both consultants, general practitioners, but also people having to do with occupation as a part of their job, which certainly was mine.
What did you do next then, so to speak?
Well, the first job I had was casualty. I was a casualty surgeon at St George's at Hyde Park Corner. And then I tossed a coin, and there were two jobs. One was with a lumber company in Canada, and I thought if I went there, I'd never come back to this country. And the other was in general practice with a mate of mine. We qualified together in Chiswick, and I landed up. I also met Wendy, my wife, and we ended up in general practice in Chiswick, where I was for 5 years. And then I joined the research department at Boots. And then we had a problem in an occupational problem. Then I joined a problem with one of the processes they had. So I was with Boots for 5 years in Nottingham. And then I moved to here, where I am now, and joined ICI in Runcorn. And eventually, all over really, because ICI had sites all over, and I became involved in different things. And I suppose we were there for until ICI, when I joined, there was 18. They had a workforce of 18,000, and when I left, had a workforce of less than 8,000. And then joined the Employment Medical Advisory Service in Bootle, in Liverpool. And I was responsible for Cheshire and Merseyside. And I saw a lot of interesting things, especially in Merseyside.
Outside your professional life, do you think the Antarctic experience shaped the future Gordon Bowrer?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Can you?
When I think back, I still see people that I was south with. People, they come and stay, or you see people that you know. And it's just like you, there isn't a problem in meeting people of that era or what have you. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think most of my friends did. There were some people I don't think that had good times down there, and I think there were some very bad years, I suspect.
Some of us talk about becoming more self-confident or broadening their experience of life, being able to, some learnt to cook down there, some became better husbands because they were more versatile.
I don't know about that. As far as cooking is concerned, I found that cooking for 30 was extremely intimidating, and I have tried never to cook since that time.
Oh, really?
And I am very against cooking. Well, I mean, for individuals, for two of you, when you're sledging things, it's not a problem. One guy cooks one day and the other guy cooks the other day. That's not a problem. But cooking for 30, you've always made too much or not enough. So, yeah, I didn't enjoy cooking for large numbers of people.
Has your ability to solve problems, do you think that has been improved by facing the challenges of the Antarctic?
Can't really answer that. You certainly look for different things. You certainly try to solve a problem rather than... there are all sorts of fids, bodges of... it's amazing what people did and how they got things to do. Yeah.
I'm not suggesting you do this on the operating table. I just
no. No, I don't think I never. I mean, apart from minor surgery as a casualty officer and or as a GP, I never did any. No, there were no fids bodges carried out in surgery.
Looking back then over the years of your life, how would you rate the Antarctic experience, those 2 years? Is it at the top there or partway down your list of memories?
Oh, at the top. Right at the top, I suspect. The other time I really enjoyed was flying while I was at school, having flown a Spitfire once and a Meteor, one after the other. But mainly chipmunks. No, I enjoyed it. No, it's a really great time of my life, I thought.
We'll leave it there, Gordon. Thank you very much indeed.